was awarded the 2017 Nobel Prize for proving that the underlying assumption of EMH, that we all make totally rational choices in pursuit of our own self-interests, is wrong. But the old guard isn't going down without a fight. Eugene Fama, also at the University of Chicago and a Nobel Prize winner for his work proving EMH back in the 1960s, once said of Thaler, "His work is interesting, but there's nothing there." Despite the recent Nobel Prizes, EMH is still being taught in every business school in the United States, and Buffett is still making 20% per year on the follies perpetuated by the EMH paradigm. What all this means is that value investing works. It really does. Find a business you really like. Wait for the inevitable economic recession to reduce earnings of public companies to start a cycle of fear in the market, and the mass selling, also known as a stock market crash, that will bring prices below their values. As most fund managers sell when other fund managers sell, there will be fewer and fewer buyers, and the prices go down. Wait for your favorite business to go on sale. Buy. Now sit back and wait for the economic cycle to increase earnings and for the inevitable greed to kick in as earnings recover and market prices tick back up as more and more buyers show up. Sell. There you go. Now what will we do for the rest of our weekend? Well, I said, sitting across from my dad, if it's so obvious and so simple, why doesn't everyone do value investing? Events, or shit happens. Dad answered with a real-life example. In 2011, the Arab Spring made it look like it might be hard for Egypt to ship its cotton. A public company called Gildan is the number one t-shirt manufacturing company in the world. It makes t-shirts for Walmart, and it buys a lot of cotton from Egypt to make those shirts. The potential shortage in cotton made the cotton price get so high that Gildan's CEO publicly said there was no way his company could be profitable for the next year. That's what I call an event. An event is the linchpin of the rule number one strategy. As distinguished from a terminal problem in a bad company, a rule number one event is an unexpected, yet temporary and rectifiable disaster that creates short to medium term uncertainty about the cash flow of a company. It could be an event that affects only that company, only that industry, or it could be market-wide. The key is that it is temporary, and we know by doing research into the company and industry and understanding how it works, how long it will take before the event is resolved and things go back to normal. But here's the thing, Dad went on. The CEO also told us the cotton shortage was temporary. They'd seen it all before and knew it was a 1 to 2 year issue. With the cotton price that high, farmers in Georgia would plant cotton from one end of the state to the other, and when that bumper crop came in a year later, prices would fall back to normal. Which is too long of a time horizon for the big investors, I realized. The practical realities of a fund manager's job proscribe writing it out. Fund managers' clients, mostly pension funds, do not like to pay fund managers to do nothing, particularly when the market is going up. By waiting to find discrepancies between price and value, a fund manager risks being beaten by the market month after month. If his performance does not keep up with his peers quarter by quarter, within a year or two, his clients will move their money to a different fund manager and he will get fired. Fund managers live in a world of competition that makes the NFL look like kindergarten. I guess so, Dad agreed. I always thought they just didn't know how to do anything but follow the herd. Because you're right, they sold off Gildan stock like it was poison. It's irrational. But I wasn't sure I saw it like that. I see what you're saying, but I don't think fund managers are acting irrationally, I thought out loud. They are acting rationally within the rules of their world that you just described. If an event happens that raises uncertainty, fund managers are forced by the nature of the industry to sell. Long-term to them is 90 days. And the recovery for this event was much longer than that. If a fund manager owns Gildan and he knows everyone else is going to bail, he can't just sit there and watch that part of his portfolio crash down 70% when his peer group is out of there. He has to exit too, even if he would rather not. I can see that, Dad acquiesced. Well, that was a revelation. Dad agreed with me. He concluded, you see that EMH can't be true. The price does not equal the value. Yes, I concurred. And I can also see that we should expect funds to exit if a long-term event happens. I should not get freaked out by that. Exactly. You should be pleased, because them selling will make the price go down, and that gives you the opportunity to buy. That's incredibly good news for me, because that means I don't have to be smarter than the pros on Wall Street. I just have to play by a different set of rules. Buffett's rules. Market-wide events. Crashes and bubbles in the market were really what I was worried about. Bubbles start because buyers think that there is someone else out there who will pay even more than they did. Not necessarily because of value. One of the first stock market bubbles in history was created when the British trading company, the South Sea Company, was granted a monopoly by the Crown to colonize South America. The near impossibility of actually conducting business in Spanish-controlled South America was not exactly public information. But everyone had heard stories of the fabulous wealth to be had there. So without South Sea having any revenue, speculators piled into the stock and drove it in a single year from £110 per share to almost £1,000 per share in 1720. This is a classic example of the potentially devastating information asymmetry between a company and its investors. There was suddenly so much demand that the facts were not at all taken into consideration when setting the price, and it didn't end any better for the poorly informed then than those of today. The bubble burst before the year was out, and the stock dropped back to £100. Now, did this prove that all the information was correctly priced into the stock price at any given moment? No, of course not. Quite the opposite. A bubble or crash was nothing more than that happening on a much larger scale, with multiple companies being priced inefficiently and incorrectly. They seemed to happen out of nowhere. Ah, Dad smiled. It does seem like that if you're not paying attention, of course. I will tell you how to find out when it's priced wrong. I've got two sources for market pricing information. One was recommended by Buffett and the other by Robert Shiller. When the market is rocketing to the moon and I'm being left behind, I keep my eye on the Shiller PE and the Buffett indicator. Shiller PE. The Shiller PE is an indicator created by Robert Shiller, author of Irrational Exuberance, mentioned earlier. To determine how over or underpriced the market is, Shiller calculates the cyclically and inflation-adjusted earnings of the S&P 500 over the past 10 years. And divides that number into the total market price of the S&P 500, a cyclically adjusted price-to-earnings, P/E, ratio. Which sounds like a food-processed mess of words, but I discovered that a chart helps a lot to understand. For those interested, we've included a copy of the Shiller P/E graph on our enhancement PDF as well. The average Shiller P/E over 140 years is 16.4. Since 1870, the Shiller PE has risen above 25 only three times. In 1929, it rose to 32, and then the market crashed down 90%. In 2000, it rose to 44, and then the market crashed down 50%. The third time is now. The Shiller PE went above 28 in 2016, and as of October 2017, it had risen to 31. Dad added, Shiller got the Nobel Prize for this analysis, and the discovery that the market can behave quite irrationally and does so regularly. The Shiller PE doesn't indicate an imminent crash. It's just an indicator to know when the whole market is badly mispriced. The market might tumble next week, or it might go straight up for another 2 years, or it might not go anywhere for 3 years. Buffett Indicator. Buffett called the ratio between the market as a whole and national revenue, quote, probably the single best measure of where valuations stand at any given moment, end quote. One measure of this is called the ratio of Wilshire 5000 Total Market Full Cap Index divided by Gross Domestic Product, colloquially called the Wilshire GDP. The Wilshire GDP ratio is tracked by the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, the Fred, and can be found at fred.stlouisfed.org. To find the Wilshire GDP, the Fred takes the stock market index that covers the most stocks, the Wilshire 5000, and calculates its capitalization, how much the entire index is worth, and divides it by the gross domestic product, the total revenue created by U.S. businesses. Dad explained, if the Wilshire GDP ratio is around 60%, then overall, the market is priced under its real value. If the ratio is over 100%, as it was in 1999, 2007, and now, it's an indication that the market is overpriced. In other words, if the market is disproportionately high compared to the country's production of real products and services, then we should be prepared for a big market downturn. The Wilshire GDP went over 100% in 2000, and the market crashed. And it went over 100% in 2008, and the market crashed again. That time, however, an extreme intervention in 2009 by the Federal Reserve Bank with a $4 trillion infusion and interest rates at 0% kept the Wilshire GDP from crashing further, and the resulting lack of alternatives for yield to investing in the stock market had the intended consequence of driving the market and real estate back up higher than before the 2008 crash. Now, the Wilshire GDP has blown through 100% to the historically unprecedented 155% it hit in the third quarter of 2017. At this level, the market price has disconnected itself entirely from the historical relationship between the actual revenues being produced by companies in the United States and the prices of the companies producing those revenues. This is not likely to be a permanent change. If you watch the Shiller PE and the Buffett indicator, you'll have a good sense of where we are in the economic cycle. And where we are now is at the top. What if we don't see a crash? What do I do? Wait for 10 years without investing? This was sounding kind of terrible, actually. All this work and I was going to end up hoarding anyway? Where the market is priced right now, relative to GDP and earnings, there has never been a time in our history when it stayed there for longer than a couple of years. Something is going to send it tumbling. But if it stays overpriced like this, there will still be opportunities to invest in specific companies in specific industries. You just keep researching, keep reading, keep looking. That way, you'll be ready when an industry-wide or market-wide event happens. Have a little faith in the strategy. Buffett isn't keeping $100 billion in cash for no reason. Wait, what? Buffett has $100 billion that he's just keeping and not investing? That's crazy. Yep, so just remember that he's waiting for an event also. Charlie Munger's first principle of investing: being capable of understanding the business. With that as our context, we sat across from each other with a microphone between us to record our first podcast. Dad started fiddling with his phone. He pulled up a video on YouTube of an old white guy in a suit who clearly didn't care what anyone else thought. He looked like someone who would think voting for a mission with my money was liberal young person nonsense destined to land me in the poorhouse. He looked like someone who would use the term poorhouse. This, Dad said, is Charlie Munger.
A note from Phil. In 1959, Charlie Munger, magna cum laude graduate from Harvard Law School, met Warren Buffett, the only person to ever get an A+ from Ben Graham at Columbia Business School, and two of the smartest men in the world became lifelong friends and investing partners. Buffett had been trained by Graham in the art of buying $10 of value for $5, but Munger added to Buffett's strategy that it's better to buy a wonderful business at a fair price than a fair business at a wonderful price. Working from that revelation for the past 50 years, Buffett and Munger bought businesses they would never sell, relying on the power of a great company to compound the investment over time and provide the highest rate of return. To Munger, the key ingredients of great investing are to be aware of what you don't know, stay rational, and wait for a great company you understand to go on sale. Munger was so good at waiting and turned down so many potential buys, Buffett now calls him the abominable no man. Munger counters that it was only 15 patiently awaited deals that put them in the top ranks of all investors. Munger's wisdom about life, integrity, rationality, patience, focus, inversion, divergence, anti-fragility, and the power of sloth, mispriced gambles, the dangers of overconfidence, and other human foibles is legendary in the investing community.
This was the guy who is as smart as Warren Buffett? Charlie Munger is Warren Buffett's partner. They've invested together for most of their lives. And in this interview I'm going to show you, he breaks down rule number one strategy into four principles. These four things are all you have to know to do well with investing. The relevant section is 1 minute long. In that 1 minute of talking, Charlie Munger succinctly summarizes 85 years of investing experience that started with his and Buffett's mentor, Benjamin Graham, in 1930. For Charlie Munger to put money into a company, 1. It must be a business he's capable of understanding. 2. It must be a business with some intrinsic characteristics that give it a durable competitive advantage. 3. He would like it to be a business that has management with integrity and talent. And 4. It must be a business that he can buy for a price that makes sense and gives a margin of safety. The margin of safety, Charlie explains, gives us comfort, considering the natural vicissitudes of life. Though I had no idea what he meant by margin of safety. Then he says, matter-of-factly, that these ideas are so obvious and so simple that there's nothing left to talk about. That's it. How to invest exactly like the best investors in the world and presumably make the same billions they do in 1 minute or less. I thought, great, there's nothing left to talk about. Those principles did seem simple. In summary, be able to comfortably predict the long-term prospects of a company and buy it at a price lower than its value, given my favorite phrase asserting that ups and downs are completely natural and inevitable, the natural vicissitudes of life. Charlie had explained it just fine. By the way, though I should probably call him Mr. Munger because of his well-deserved status as a senior statesman of the value investing world, I'm going to call him Charlie because I feel such fondness for him, like he's become my crotchety great uncle who serves up wisdom while complaining about kids today, and kids means anyone under the age of 50. And I note that he does not remove himself from such annoying kids, but rather chooses to make himself available to kids like me with this BBC interview, which I take as an indication that he secretly enjoys either us or the attention or both. And thus, to me, he is Charlie. Oh no, Dad warned. There's plenty to talk about. I internally rolled my eyes at this guy, who just disagreed with Buffett's investing partner. We are going to go through his principles one by one, Dad said, and it's going to take a few months. Really? I side-eyed him. Months? They seem pretty simple and straightforward. He laughed. He laughed at Charlie. Oh no, wait, I realized. He was laughing at me for thinking Charlie's principles were so easy. They do seem simple, he chuckled, but they're deep. There is a lot there, as you'll see once we start to talk about them. The principles are in a specific order of importance. I'm going to go through them one by one. This month, we'll work on what he means by being capable of understanding. I have never been so dead wrong. Charlie may have distilled his investing methodology into four easily soundbited principles, but there is a Hoover Dam-sized depth underneath them. They have framed our entire discussion about investing. They frame my investing decisions now. I doubt we will ever stop discussing them. And that is why Uncle Charlie is the master. His first principle is a doozy. Being capable of understanding sounds simple, right? Should I put my mind to it? I'm capable of understanding pretty much anything. But how could I ever consider myself capable of truly, madly, deeply understanding a publicly traded company? There are vast amounts of information about these companies that I can never know. The distribution of information between a company and its investors is wildly misaligned. Plus, truly understanding a company requires understanding its competition and its industry, which is a whole other endeavor. And understanding an industry requires understanding its relationship to other industries, which requires understanding those industries individually as well. And obviously, I'd need to understand the market as a whole to understand how this industry and this company fit into it. And how can I expect myself to understand the market as a whole when I'm just beginning at all this? And enclosed concrete stairwell feeling! The stairwell is deep, and I was burrowing my way into the damp darkness, right there, across from my dad. I started to see what he meant when he said there's a lot to these principles. I took a step back, noticed that I was mentally spiraling down, and took a breath. "Dad," I ventured, "on one level, I'd say I'm capable of understanding right now. And on the broader macroeconomic level, I'd say there's no way I'm going to be capable of understanding until I've been working at this for years. What is he talking about?" Dad nodded. Notice that Charlie did not say that he has to currently understand the company. He used the future tense, not present. No, he has to consider himself capable of understanding in the future, rather than currently understanding it from the get-go. Ah, that was a big difference. It was being able to project that, should I put the work in, I would be able to understand that company, not that I had to understand it at the beginning. Even Charlie doesn't understand companies straight away. That made me feel better. Okay, I pondered. So how do I know in advance that if I put the work in, I can understand a given business and industry? I don't have time to waste on chasing dead ends. Think of this business like buying your condo, my dad suggested. Just like with buying a condo, you've got to know the neighborhood and the long-term implications of that location. For public companies, the neighborhood is the industry. That's all. Understand it the way you would understand a neighborhood. What has it been through? What are its cycles? What are its good spots and bad spots? And where do you think it's going over the next 10 to 20 years? Are the schools getting better or worse? Stores opening or closing? Incomes going up or down? Prices going up or down? I got it. Two seemingly opposite ideas can be true at the same time. I am completely capable of understanding some companies, and there is such a vast amount of information that knowing all of it is impossible. Both things are true. And they are true for every single company, from a kid's lemonade stand to a rental house to Enron. As investors, we live in the tension between those two truths. And when we find between them the sweet spot of understanding how this company is expected to behave in response to unknowable events, we invest. Thinking of my condo purchase helped a lot. I could handle a condo analysis. I could do condo. Here's the key, my dad concluded. Here's the key to the whole thing that will keep you safe. If it's not condo in bold or obvious, don't do it. If it's not that obvious, it's not a good investment for you. We want to jump over 6-inch bars, not 6-foot bars. You're just starting out with this. Keep it obvious. Keep it simple, stupid, I laughed. Dad didn't laugh. Exactly. He called it his rule of obviousness, and it made me feel better. I didn't have to push myself into anything I wasn't 100% sure of, or anything I wasn't ready for. I thought about the condo. Durable competitive advantage. Location on Pearl Street Mall. In a great building. In Boulder. Beautiful. Backed by the University of Colorado and 40 minutes to Denver. Basically, if the price was right, a no-brainer. That was a 6-inch bar to jump over. I could jump that. I had jumped that. Buffett, my dad grinned, has a box on his desk. A too-hard box. He wants to put companies in the too-hard box. He's dying for an excuse to throw things in the too-hard box. And you should be too. Don't be afraid of saying something is too hard. Find the low bars to jump over, not the high bars. Charlie is saying that to look into a company, you should use your own innate knowledge and experience to determine if this company is potentially in your sweet spot, or if it's just, right now, today, too hard. The thing is, though, everything seems too hard. That's an excellent observation about where you are in the process. Right now, you have no idea if it's even possible to understand a business because you haven't studied or researched even a single company. But once you start reading and getting a sense of what's out there, you'll quickly get enough perspective to start to know when you're capable or not. And just to put this process in perspective, experienced rule number one investors expect at least 90% of what we look at to be too hard, or an outright no. 90%? That's nuts. Almost nothing gets through. That's exactly right. Remember that. And for beginners like you, it'll be even fewer. Okay, so I only need to find a few companies at first, and then build up. And you need to understand the industry, which you can totally do, just choose one that's an easy one for you. You don't get any extra points for studying industries that you know nothing about. You live in the world, you know lots of industries actually. Choose one you know something about. To determine if I was capable of understanding an industry or company, I needed to do some preliminary research to see if I was familiar with its basic concepts. If I wasn't, it was too hard. I needed to review the market-wide indicators to see if the overall climate was one that supported companies being on sale or overpriced. And I should look for events. Events were a way to use my fear as a lever to get incredible investing results. I knew that if I was initially fearful, others were too. However, they would act on their fear by selling, while I would act on mine by waiting. To be ready to act aggressively when fear is everywhere seems to be one of the great paradoxes of rule number one investing. Our practice demands extreme patience and extreme courage to invest when smart people are running for the hills. Dad said Warren Buffett called it laziness bordering on sloth. But really, it's the patience of a hunter to do nothing when companies are overpriced, and to strike aggressively and buy when companies are priced far below their value. I noticed that all the information I had learned so far was actually attacking my fear of the unknown. Instead of trying to eradicate my fear, which was probably futile, being aware of the fear might help me to avoid dumb investments. If I was feeling afraid, other investors probably were too. That feeling gave me valuable information about the market. The hard part was going to be discerning when the fear was irrational and when it was warning me of real danger. I wasn't going to figure that out on my own. I needed my teacher. I was getting a bit of a sense of the vastness of information that real investors like Charlie have, and that I could learn not only from my dad, but also from Charlie and other great investors. It was a quick reminder that, just as in yoga, I'll always be a student in this practice. Warren Buffett, Charlie, other major value investors, and my dad were all my teachers. I wouldn't be alone in this. Nor would I be reinventing the wheel they had already designed and crash-tested. The tradition of masters my dad was talking about was real. These master investors had been making millions and even billions of dollars since the 1930s. This was definitely not something new and untried. I felt more confident. It was the unknown that scared me. But the information that this investment tradition had been working so well for so long was alleviating my fear. And now I had some tools that gave me perspective on the market overall, which was rather extraordinary. Knowing nothing about what was happening in the market overall had been one of my huge fears a few months ago. Then we dialed it down, from the vastness of the market as a whole to specific companies. Research time. Circle of competence. Right now, I'm going to teach you about your circle of competence. We're going to talk about how to research companies and how to create your own focus on 1 to 2 industries. Buffett calls this focus your circle of competence. You already have one without even knowing it. Think of all the companies you have opinions about. I tried to think of a company I had an opinion on. He explained, Having an opinion is a good clue that there's an industry you might know pretty well already because you already have some perspective on it. I spent years in the Army becoming something of a weapons expert, so it was easy for me to have an opinion when it came to putting my money in a firearms company. I already had an opinion about those companies. I already knew what I thought about those companies' products. I just had to look into their company structure and management to see if the companies themselves were good investments, because I didn't know about that stuff without researching it. I remembered the four levels of mastery. You'll know you're consciously competent when you know what you don't know. That's the edge. Okay, I thought out loud. I need to choose where to start my initial circle of competence. How do I choose where to spend my time? I suppose there are some industries I know about, just from life. I like yoga, I like cooking and entertaining, I like startup tech companies. But I don't know exactly what industry the financial world divides those into. Let's do this, my dad suggested. There's an exercise that Jim Collins uses in his book Good to Great to determine what companies I should be focusing on that I use for investing. We'll make three circles. And the convergence of the three is where you start creating your circle of competence. A Venn diagram of competence? Exactly. I grabbed a legal pad from my shelf of legal pads. A legal pad and a good pen go a long way towards my happiness. Just one more example of money supporting my happiness. So I keep a joyful stack of them for times exactly like this one. I drew three circles overlapping in the middle, and he told me to label them. Let's make the three circles what you're passionate about, what you vote for with your money, and where you make your money. We took a 15-minute break so I could fill in the circles, which I'll describe in a moment. You can also reference the Venn diagram on the enhancement PDF. The first circle was fairly easy. About what am I passionate? Yoga, cars, startups and legal stuff, eating healthy foods, cooking, throwing dinner parties and entertaining, sleeping as much as I can. Snowboarding. For the second circle, I had to think a while about where my money was going, and therefore what I had already been voting for in the world, without thinking too much about it. Grocery stores like Whole Foods and Safeway, my mortgage with Chase, furniture and home goods stores like Restoration Hardware, Crate and Barrel, TJ Maxx, Williams-Sonoma, my car, a Nissan, clothing stores like Zappos, air travel on United, Delta, Southwest, restaurants like Chipotle, Subway. I checked my Amazon account to see what I'd been voting for with my money recently. I had even ordered toilet paper on Amazon. Charmin. I searched online for who owns Charmin toilet paper. Procter & Gamble bought it in 1957. Charmin developed the Sit or Squat public restroom finder. Parenting Magazine called Sit or Squat one of the best apps for simplifying a parent's life. Roto-Rooter said Charmin was used by more plumbers than any other brand. Better Homes and Gardens named Charmin Ultra Strong to its Best New Products of 2013 list. I am not making this up. Charmin sounded fantastic, and I had never viewed my toilet paper with such interest. I added Procter & Gamble and Amazon to my list. Second circle. What do I vote for with my money? Groceries, household goods, startups, yoga, cool cars, healthy food, travel, snowboarding, clothes. The third circle was the easiest. Where do I make my money? Legal work, startups, and I didn't, but I was pretty sure I could make money on this. Dinner parties and entertaining. My overlapping circles were startups, yoga, cars, healthy food, and entertaining. It was actually pretty helpful to see it drawn out in black and white so I could refer to it going forward as I searched for companies. You can see it drawn out as well on the enhancement PDF. I showed it to my dad, and he nodded in approval. Now what? Is that my circle of competence? Almost, he said, because the three circles don't quite make your investing circle of competence. Doing the three circles exercise narrows down the industries you should start with. We start with businesses and industries we already are involved with in some way. Then we narrow down again to create the circle of competence for investing. Should I only end up with one industry to start with? Yes. Focus and start with one. Do the work on that one. What companies are in it that you already know? In a high-priced market, mostly you're just putting companies that are wonderful on a wish list to be bought later when the market makes its inevitable downturn. Don't worry about actually buying anything at this point. You're just going to build a shopping list. I need to find out what industries startups, yoga, cars, and healthy food fall into. It's not toilet paper. I mentioned how much fun I had investigating Charmin. He replied that he had encouraged his guests on his Grand Canyon River trips for their visits to the, quote, bathroom to try out using smooth river rocks that had been warmed by the sun. Helpful. But see, he pointed out, you have an opinion about toilet paper, and you didn't even realize it. That's going to be true for many companies and industries as you get more into this. You'll find that you know a lot more than you think once you put your attention on it. For now, though, to start out in practice, stay focused on your circle of competence. Find out what other companies there are in the industry and learn how they relate to each other. What are the economic cycles of that industry? Is the company you're interested in going with the overall trend of the industry or against it? Are there regular ebbs and flows? Or does the company's profit usually go up with the economy and down with a recession? Or is it counter-cyclical? Alrighty then. I went through my results. Startups can go public, but that's a whole other game of speculation. That left cars, healthy food, and yoga. I thought about my Nissan Xterra, which I loved as an off-roading beast, but not particularly because of its Nissan-ness. But the auto industry could be very interesting. Then I thought of Whole Foods. Now, that was a store I had feelings about. I really loved that company for helping change the world in so many ways, from making natural and organic food a normal and expected offering at the store, to its consciously capitalist attitude towards business. I could extrapolate from specific companies like Whole Foods to the industry, grocery stores, or from Nissan to the automobile industry. But yoga was harder. There isn't an industry called yoga. There aren't many publicly traded companies that have to do with yoga or its accessories, like mats and yoga videos specifically. But I thought of Lululemon and their efforts to reinvent their image and expand their brand. If you go to a yoga class, I promise that at least half of the women will be wearing Lululemon. Their clothing is expensive, but it lasts. And I wear their gear more than most of my other clothes, so the per-wear dollar amount ends up being quite low. Lululemon, though, had a problematic founder who had made comments that Lululemon's yoga pants weren't meant for larger women. And indeed, their pants weren't made in sizes larger than 12. From an athletic wear company, that's a particularly poor message. A month after his comments, he was forced out, and the stock price dropped a third and kept going. They have since gotten a new CEO and have been recovering. So how did I find the industries of things I like if the industry isn't obvious? My dad offered some help. You can use my website, Rule One Investing, or another one like Yahoo Finance to find out. Here's a free website, InvestSnips, that has an industries tab. Click it and scroll down to category links, and you'll see about 450 categories from advertising to zinc. This site reclassifies companies according to category of interest. The yoga category, for example, has two companies, Lululemon and Gaiam. We know Lululemon makes yoga clothing. How would you find out what Gaiam does? I'd start with the annual reports, I sighed. The U.S. agency that regulates companies, the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, has tried to solve the information deficit and protect investors by requiring a comprehensive annual report from each company on the stock exchange, among other filings. That's me, the potential investor who needs to be protected. The annual report is a written document that tends to be very long and is submitted to the SEC on its Form 10-K, so it is interchangeably called the annual report or the 10-K. It describes, in great detail, the work of a company, its plans, its financials, and all the ways the company could potentially fail. I have to determine from my research if a monolithic company is quavering, and the annual report is the first place to look. I've read many annual reports in my practice as an attorney, but thankfully have never had to write one. They are notoriously boring. Still, they're like the celebrity gossip blogs. Once you read a few, you learn where to sniff out the really juicy stuff and just skim over the rest. Public companies also file reports every quarter, called the 10Q, and hold calls with analysts every quarter that are recorded and transcribed. These can all be found on the company's website for investor relations, or if they don't have a good website, on the SEC's website. My dad thinks the SEC's website, called EDGAR, is tough to use, but I don't find it that difficult, and I like getting things from the official source. Reading annual reports is a major project, I complained. You want me to randomly read them? I started to think that maybe I could wander around in these weeds forever. Was there an easier way to do this? Yes, there is. Another way to narrow down is to start looking to other investors, my dad announced. I call them my gurus. I look at what they're buying and check it out. Gurus. I thought about it. Everyone running a fund of $100 million or more must report quarterly to the SEC the equity positions they have bought and sold in the previous quarter. That's a great idea. They have to file publicly anyway, and the information is a little old, but that's not a big deal for a value investor. I thought about it some more. Wait, why aren't I just copying what they're buying? He laughed. No, I'm serious. Why do I even need to do all this work on my own when they can do it for me? Why couldn't you have told me this months ago? Dad stopped laughing. Actually, he agreed, you're right. It's my favorite way to find great investments. There were two professors who wanted to see what would have happened if all you did was copy Warren Buffett from when he started to be quite famous until recently. They got the data from his quarterly 13F filings with the SEC from 1976 to 2006. To model it as conservatively as possible, they, quote, bought the stock he was buying on the last day of the month that it was public knowledge that Buffett was buying, and they, quote, sold it on the last day of the month it became public that he was selling. I vaguely remember Dad mentioning this study back when he was convincing me that I could successfully invest on my own. And it worked. Their model made a ton of money just by copying Buffett. I wanted to see details. We looked up the study by Professors Martin and Puthenprockel. They found that an investor who did nothing but copy Berkshire Hathaway's public company investments for those 31 years would have gotten a 20.43% compounded annual gain, while the market index would have returned half that amount. Footnote, according to MoneyChimp, the compounded annual growth rate of the S&P 500 index from 1976 to 2006, including dividends, was 12.86%. The two researchers concluded that Buffett's returns were not due to luck. Furthermore, while Buffett's rate of return was approximately twice that of the market, his actual cash return was 5 times larger. This is a feature of compounded returns. A small change in the compounded rate of return can, over time, result in a very large change in actual dollars. For professors to admit it's not luck, is pretty unusual, my dad said. They don't like to admit that choosing individual companies can beat the market. I thought about the study. I wouldn't have even had to buy stocks at all, except Berkshire. Dad, forget doing all this work. Why don't we just buy Berkshire and be done with it? If we buy Berkshire when it's really cheap, then yes, that's a great plan. You'll get no argument from me. But how will you know it's cheap? It's the same as when you wanted to abdicate. Fine, but you have to know how to evaluate them, and that takes investing expertise. Same thing here. Buying Berkshire might be a good call, but how will you know if it's a good price without learning investing? Silence from me. Stop telling me I have to know something about investing in order to copy other people! Fine. I won't know when it's a good price, I admitted. I have no clue. Right, Dad affirmed. Plus, Berkshire isn't cheap often, and that means we're probably better off copying what they're buying. Also, Buffett isn't going to run Berkshire forever. He has great people in place and has assured us they will do a good job. But who knows? Still, if I can buy Berkshire cheap enough, I'm going to buy it. Keep my own counsel, I said, half to myself. and I can always buy the companies Berkshire buys if they fit my mission. There is a short list of other investors who invest in the Rule Number One style and get high returns year over year, sometimes even in markets that are strangely inflated, like this one. Dad looks to Buffett and Munger, obviously, but also Monish Pabrai, Guy Spier, David Einhorn, Bruce Berkowitz, and a bunch of others. Dad has a list of gurus he follows for ideas on his own website. I can find their 13F filings on the SEC's EDGAR website. I could copy them, but I was already seeing a few problems with my idea. It's the lawyer in me. I poke holes even in my own arguments. Dad, the obvious problem is that because they are reporting one quarter after they purchase or sell, the information is always old. I should take it with a mountain of salt? Well, Dad said slowly, imagine you could get 46 of the world's best investors to call you up personally about what they've been buying or selling over the last 90-day period. That would be pretty valuable, right? Even information a year old would be valuable, if only for ideas and examples. Many times, I've found that the price of a company has actually gone down since great investors bought it more than 120 days ago. For example, Warren Buffett bought a bunch of IBM stock repeatedly from 2011 to 2016 at prices that averaged about $170. You could have bought IBM in 2016 for $120. That happens all the time. But you do have to know what you're looking at. You still have to do the homework. And even more importantly, make sure their mission matches my missions, I added. A guru might buy a company that is antithetical to my values, and I refuse to blindly copy them. Exactly, Dad nodded vigorously. Copying someone else blindly is a lot like abdicating. You've got to do your own homework to know if what they're doing is a good thing or not. The other thing to remember is keep a guru's purchases in perspective against their overall fund. Buffett has about $100 billion in cash right now, and none of that shows up in his 13F filings. If you didn't know about how much cash he's keeping, you'd think he was fully invested, when in fact, he's sitting on the largest pile of cash in his whole life, just waiting for the inevitable economic storm to put everything on sale that he wants to buy. Additionally, it is extremely important to know that 13F filings do not report short positions. Some investors hedge stocks by selling weaker companies short, betting they will go down instead of up, while buying stronger companies with the expectation that if the market goes up, the strong ones will go up more than the weak ones, and they'll make money on the difference. Same thing if the market goes down, but in reverse. The weak companies will drop faster and farther than the strong companies. Watching the 13F filings can be misleading if you aren't aware of the whole picture, but even so, following the 13F filings of the right people can be quite an advantage. Every quarter, the list of new buys comes out, around 500 to 600 companies to look at each quarter, and that's just from the gurus my dad follows. Get an idea of if what they do is in your circle of competence, and then, if it is, go deep in your research. But always remember that while it's a really cool shortcut to finding something you might want to buy, the 13F filings paint an incomplete picture of any guru's holdings. My skeptical legal training kicked in, and as I reviewed the companies gurus had chosen, I noticed that either I could not guess why they bought a company, or I did not support the mission of a company they bought. I refused to blindly depend on my father or any other guru. Professional investors are smart people, but investing is not about being smart. It's about knowing that what you're buying will be worth more in 10 years and being patient. Many professional investors get scared and do stupid things. Charlie Munger says that he and Warren Buffett wouldn't be so rich if smart people didn't do so many stupid things. My job in this practice was to avoid being one of those people. This, my dad believes, is the key to successful personal investing. Learning how to use predictably irrational and emotional short-term decisions of others to my advantage. I felt like I was getting comfortable with knowing if I was capable of understanding a company, but I hadn't really tested it out. I needed to work on my investing practice, I needed some perspective on my own skills, quickly. How could I create a good baseline of investing research? My investing intensive. Read Warren Buffett's letters, Dad advised for a second time. He's written letters to his shareholders for about 40 years. They are an unbelievable education in value investing, and they're a pretty good read. I searched online for Warren Buffett letters to shareholders and got a link to Berkshire Hathaway's shareholder letters, available for PDF download. All of them since 1977 were there. I hadn't known the provenance of Berkshire Hathaway, but Warren Buffett, I discovered, used the vehicle of a textile company called Berkshire Hathaway to form an investing company. Berkshire is not a fund. He simply uses this company, which is public, to purchase other companies, public and private ones. And he writes a letter every year to his Berkshire Hathaway shareholders. These letters are held up as the pinnacle of shareholder letters because it's incredibly rare for a public company executive to write to shareholders the way Buffett does. Openly, straightforwardly, and honestly about what the company is doing, about its failures as much as its successes, about its plans for the future, and about its intentions regarding its values and where it is going. Value investors talk about these letters like they're the Bible. I figured Dad was on to something. I'd better read the letters. Reading the Buffett Bible would lay the groundwork for my research to come. So, read the Buffett Bible, I would. Reading 3 letters per day would take me about 2 weeks to finish all of them since 1977. When I went home to Boulder, I got started. In yoga, a multi-day focused practice is called an intensive. I planned my 2-week investing intensive to ground the information I had learned over the last few months into skills. Water the root to enjoy the fruit. It was an old maxim from my transcendental meditation upbringing, and it was a good one that I remembered often. In the meditation context, it means that meditation is the food or water needed by the consciousness, so that out of meditation, one can enjoy the fruits of that time spent turned inward. In my investing practice, it reminded me to learn. The water was the knowledge about how to do rule number 1 investing. The root was my practice, and the fruit was financial freedom. I wanted to read Buffett's letters since my dad spoke so highly of them, and I wanted to start developing more perspective on the market. In my legal practice, I often found myself advising clients simply on what was normal. Normal deal terms, normal issues a startup often runs into, normal conflicts between founders, normal documents they should have at the ready. It was vital information to a startup or venture capitalist that we could provide, because we handled so many deals. I noticed that I had no clue about what was normal in the stock market, and I knew I had better find out before I put my own money into it. The letters to shareholders are fundamental. What else? I decided to back up. Instead of checking celebrity gossip in the morning as I drank coffee and woke up, I'd start every morning by reading a business newspaper. Losing my moment of gossip zen would be a major sacrifice, but it was probably good for me. Well, maybe I would make myself wait to skim the gossip until after I read the Wall Street Journal. Yeah, that sounded a lot better already. I looked up the Wall Street Journal and discovered it was quite expensive to subscribe. Then I went to the Financial Times website, similarly expensive. I checked the New York Times, also expensive. Good Lord, I quickly realized that if I subscribed to 4 or 5 news sources at their full prices, I'd be at $100 a month. $1,200 per year of investing news was a serious annual expenditure for me, and one that would cut into my investing budget. This practice apparently required not only a time investment, but some financial investment. And really, what better place to put my money than to support strong business journalism? The Fourth Estate protects me, the small investor, better than the SEC or any regulatory agency could. It finds scandal and publicizes it, bringing light to the dark corners of back rooms and trading desks. I decided to pay for the Wall Street Journal and see how much I really read it. If I decided paying for the other newspapers would be worthwhile, I could add them to my reading lists later. I made a folder in my web browser bookmarks called Investing, and added the free websites my dad had mentioned. Every day for 2 weeks, I read 1 + 3 as my investing intensive. 1 Wall Street Journal business section in the morning and 3 shareholder letters by Warren Buffett by bedtime. The Buffett Bible was exactly as good as my dad had described. Buffett has an incredible ability to explain financial concepts to normals like me, and that is rare. Too rare. Maybe it's a clue to why he's so good at common sense investing. April practice. Starting research is hard, but this is the month to do it. It took me a few tries and some boredom before I started to find the good stuff, so be prepared with snacks and a sense of humor. Run through your own three circles exercise so you know where to focus your investing research, and then just start. Choose a newspaper for business news and read it regularly. Maybe do your own investing intensive and read the Buffett Bible. Look at some 13F filings. Think about what would work best for you and your schedule, and then go for it. Chapter 5. Charlie's Moat and Management. May. This month. Moat. Big four numbers and growth rates. Windage growth rate. Management. Checklist for Charlie's first three principles. It was the strangest thing. All this thinking about financial freedom and working toward it seemed to create freedom in ways I didn't expect. For years, I had been promising my grad school flatmate to come visit her in Zurich, Switzerland. I switched law firms to a boutique firm focused on startups, and in between jobs, I had the opportunity to go. I wandered around the city alone while she was at the office, and after work hours, we sunned ourselves by the lake and drank good wine. And I felt purely myself, more so than in a long time. I felt free. On the last night I was in Zurich, she invited a friend over for a game of Risk. And by the end of the game, I liked that man sitting next to me more than anyone I had ever met. Nuno was Portuguese, gallant, and devastatingly smart. He was a strategy consultant to banks, which is why he lived in Zurich, and he seemed fascinated by my efforts to improve my life, which I appreciated because I still felt a bit hesitant to tell other people about my investing practice. They seemed to immediately assume I knew all about investing, and I certainly did not. I was scheduled to stop at Oxford for an entrepreneurship conference for a few days on the way home, and Nuno asked if he could come hang out before I went back across the Atlantic. I was in vacation mode and said, sure, and only realized the next day that a virtual stranger might follow me to another country. Our mutual friend assured me he was trustworthy, and I remembered his dark gray-green dreamy eyes and the way he looked at me with a certain unwavering intention. And I remembered that I was on vacation and this didn't matter. I let him know where I would be. After he flew to London, rented a car in a hotel room, and showed up to meet me at the King's Arms pub in the center of Oxford, I was impressed. 3 days later, I was very much in danger of falling in love with a guy who lived in Europe. When I went home, Nuno asked to come visit me in Boulder, and I decided to let him. Before Nuno came to visit, Dad stopped into Boulder again for business, and we made sure he could stay over the weekend so we could talk about Charlie's principles in person. I was becoming accustomed to this constant contact with my dad. We used to talk every 2 or 3 weeks. Now we talked or texted at least once a week and emailed each other articles we found about value investing or companies we ran across that we thought were cool. It was actually really nice. He was sticking with me. We sat down in my living room. It was time for Charlie's second and third principles, ensuring the competitive advantage of a company, and then evaluating the people running the company. We got down to business. Charlie Munger's second principle of investing, intrinsic and durable competitive advantage. This second principle is mega. To me, it's the crux of Charlie's principles of investing. Charlie says that once we have decided we're capable of understanding the business, the next thing is to determine whether the business has an intrinsic competitive advantage that is durable. In Buffett's investing strategy, this concept is referred to as a moat. A moat is exactly what we all think of, the body of water surrounding a castle to prevent attacks. In investing, the castle is the business, and the moat is the competitive advantage the business intrinsically has that makes it near untouchable by competitors for long-term cash flow. If a business has a good moat, it's going to be hard for competitors to breach the moat and take the castle. Not impossible, but difficult. So difficult that they won't try. So difficult that if they had all the money it would cost to buy the whole company, they still couldn't compete with it.